Hello, and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures Podcast, presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shoshanworks, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we build for resilient futures. Today, we're continuing our investigation into the ways that AI is informing ecosystems across industry and society, and exploring how we design pathways to resilient futures.
On today's episode, we'll be discussing the economics of AI with Luke Frobe. I'm joined today by my co-host, James Villarrubia. James?
Thanks, Ed. Hello, everyone. My name is James Villarrubia. I'm a White House Innovation Fellow, digital strategist for CASC, Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Group, inside NASA, where I help engineers and scientists use AI in everyday science and research, and hopefully to improve the work that we do at NASA. So back to you, Ed.
Thanks, James. We are also welcoming to the podcast today Professor Luke Frobe, who's a leading figure in the economics of competition policy. At present, Luke is a professor at Vanderbilt University's Owens Graduate School of Management. And previously, he was the chief economist at the U.S. Department of Justice and at the Federal Trade Commission. Welcome, Luke.
I'm thrilled to be here. So my background is I used to be a long-haired do-gooder trying to make the world a better place. And now I am a wiser and older economist who knows that markets do much better than government.
So, Luke, welcome. Good to have you here. Maybe you could just give us a little background on AI and where you began to have exposure to it and what you see the role of AI in the markets.
Early on, when I was at the Justice Department, we were always interested in we're evaluating mergers, and it was a very logical step. Do this, you delineate the market, you do this. And I was thinking about, we could automate a lot of this stuff with logical AI. But the other kind of AI, which is the way more interesting, is machine learning. You train a system, not necessarily logically, and they interpret what you're doing with data. And so they're able to draw inferences from non-experimental data. And I got very interested in that. Early on when I was at the Justice Department, I was loaned to the Sentencing Commission to look at sentences for federal crimes. Federal law is the same everywhere. So if you get convicted in different state, same criminal, same crime, you ought to be serving the same time. But there's tremendous between district variation in sentencing. So if you get these data are my experience that I'm talking about is 30 or 40 years old. So if you were convicted of a bank robbery in the Southern District of New York, you'd serve half the time that you did if you're convicted of the exact same criminal doing the exact same crime in South Carolina. And our job at the Sentencing Commission was to get rid of that between district variations so that we could say that the same criminal doing the same crime, same federal crime, would serve the same time.
Yeah. So you were using some early machine learning. How'd that go? Did it go well?
We were able to make, we gave sense ranges. We didn't eliminate all the discretion, but there's now the guidelines are there. There are guidelines. So you have to, if you deviate from the guidelines, there's this implicit kind of assumption that you're going to have to justify your deviation, but at least there people say, oh yeah, these are the factors that we could identify using econometrics to predict, you know, what the sentences were. And I think we're able to make some progress, but like a lot of people, you go in, you go out, and I didn't really follow up with what happened to the sentencing guidelines.
So what you were doing, I presume, was you were taking a set of facts around a particular case and then training a machine to predict the sentence that would be expected. The independent variables were the characteristics of the case, and then the dependent variable.
And the criminal, the case and the criminal, and the output was the sentence that they received. And so to me, machine learning is just econometrics, which is the drawing inference from non-experimental data. What is this non-experimental data showing you? And machine learning has gotten much better at taking a set of kind of factors and making predictions, but it still doesn't solve the fundamental problems of causality. What's causing what? So you don't know if you see X is causing Y, or, and machine learning can give you a really good predictor of Y given X from X, but it doesn't tell you that the causality is going from X to Y. I mean, the causality could be going the other way. And that problem hasn't been solved. And so, you know, in a sense, it's very reassuring that machine learning is not going to be able to solve the reverse prediction problem. I mean, there's analogs in machine learning that do that, but you still have to address those issues, which are conceptual issues. So you have to write down a model, and conditional on the model being right, then you can estimate it much more precisely with machine learning.
So this question of causality reminds me, there was in the early chess playing machines, the machines began to make moves and then quickly would surrender the queen, because the machine had predicted that once you surrendered the queen, you're about to have checkmate. So this turned out to be a wrong inference about causality versus correlation in winning moves. So when you look at this kind of variation in sentencing and other things, are there mistakes that we've seen from the prior instantiations of less sophisticated machines? That what are the analogs of what we might see arising out of generative AI?
Oh man, yeah. I mean, generative AI. I mean, it's getting good so much more quickly. And I've been using it for about 6 or 8 months to review economics literature and help me write articles. It's very good, but it's stupid in the same way that it can't distinguish correlation from causality. It'll say stuff that doesn't make much sense. But you can work with it, prompt engineering. If you learn how to use it, you can make it bark like a dog. And the more you use it, the better off the better it gets. And I think as we learn to use it more, it'll become a really valuable tool. I've got my students at Vanderbilt doing their assignments in using Claude or whatever AI they want to use to make up questions for my next generation textbook. It's a scam, actually. But so each question, they feed the chapter summary into the thing and they come up with questions, but they have to edit. The key is they have to edit them to make them good questions. The generative AI is just not that good at it.
I assume drawing inferences here from the work that you were talking about at the Department of Justice in terms of sentencing guidelines. As you mentioned, it was not experimental data. It was sort of just data on sort of what the crime stats were at the time, with all of that bias and procedural issues sort of baked in there. And I see that sort of same mistake being made in discussing generative AI as a sort of magical solution that knows all, when in fact it's drawing on all of the bias that is latent in the writings that it's absorbed over the history of English, or now lots of foreign languages being sort of built in these models. But there are gaps in that. There are misunderstandings in that that it cannot account for because it doesn't know any better. It is simply working with the information. There's no experimental test to data of like, oh, here's what Earth 2 wrote and here's what Earth 1 wrote, and let's compare the two and see which performs better. But I mean, are you seeing your students struggle with that sort of structural bias of the data itself, being able to sort of, hey, it actually only knows what it was told. How do we do new work? How do we, you know, examine new ideas?
Well, the classes, they've only had one assignment so far, so it's too early to really
early days.
But you know, there's some that are better than worse. I'll tell you a funny story that I read the other day, that my former agency, the Department of Justice, I can't remember if it was the FTC or DOJ, I think it was the FTC. They found that one of the search engines was showing, or what it was showing certain kinds of ads to certain kinds of people, and I forgot what it was exactly. I think they were showing certain kind of jobs to men and women, different kinds of jobs and women, based on how likely they were to accept the click on the ad or show the ad. And the FTC thought that was bias, when it was really probably reflecting the preferences of the people who are clicking. I mean, when they show them those ads, they know that if the AI is really good, it knows what their preferences are based on repeated buys and, you know, what they're looking at and things like that. And they're showing them ads that they want to see. Is that discrimination? I mean, but that's, I forgot who it was. It was either the Consumer Protection Division or the Civil Rights Division. I can't remember who it was, but they went after them and they said the I forget which of the defendants, who are the victims, or not victims, yeah, the victims of the government making the, say, oh yeah, we'll make a better effort to make sure that we show them houses in this area, or we show them this kinds of jobs, or, but that's what happens when you get really good at prediction. I'm going to be able to predict your preferences. And if you've got a preference that's related to your gender, it's going to show women different kinds. Or I'll be, if women have different kinds of preferences than men, it's going to show them different things. And is that discriminatory? Yeah, I don't.
I think you hit on a real important point here is, I mean, a lot of companies are struggling with this idea of sort of post-hoc analysis and post-hoc bias remediation and mitigation, because they're getting these large language models. They don't know the data that went in, and they can only sort of, you know, after the fact, post-hoc evaluate it. But they are in effect trying to extract out and mitigate bias, which is confounded by the inputs, which are the social bias that the users bring in already. Because it's not like the machine is going to compensate.
I would call it social bias. I would call preferences.
If societal.
I can predict what your preferences are and give you what you want. And you want different things. And women, on average, want different things than men. We're going to be able to observe the average difference of men and women. And is that discriminatory? The way discrimination law has been traditionally, and I've been an expert witness in a couple discrimination cases, the way it's traditionally worked is that if the plaintiffs can show that there's a disparate impact, the burden of proof shifted to the defendants to show that it's justified in some way. And here, I think that the way these AI models are trained and updated, I think they have that the justification would be, yeah, that's what the people want. And we're just giving them what they want. And I'd be really curious what a court would say about that. But yeah, we're giving you what you want. That's discriminatory because you have, in your heart, you're biased or something. I don't know. It just seems ludicrous to me.
We're probably going to find out pretty soon, given the rate of cases coming before the court and the speed of AI. So
Luke, with all the recent discussions about regulating AI to ensure safety and security, what are your thoughts about the various stakeholders in the AI ecosystem and their policy interests? And what does this regulation do for, say, the incumbents versus the new entrants? And is the call for regulation inherently anti-competitive?
Oh, yeah. I think it's a huge mistake. It's like cart before the horse. Before we know what the exact problems are and what's causing them, we're saying, oh, yeah, we ought to regulate them using 20th century or 21st century tools. And we're well into the 22nd century. And I think it's going to be a huge mistake. And because it's going to slow down innovation. And just beyond that, it's like, okay, so, and given the slowness of government enforcement to find these problems and correct them, who's going to have the incentive to correct them more quickly? And I think here it's very clear that the AI companies themselves have a huge incentive to get that right. And if they don't, they lose their customers. And so they want to make sure that they're giving their customers what they want. If their customer, and anyway, so, and I've seen this in advertising. So for example, online advertising. So when you click on an ad, you're seeing a bunch of ads that come up at the top of the page. They're running these auctions in real time and giving you results in like less than half a second. And the advertisers are bidding on your clicks. And I tell my students in class, I said, do any of you click on the sponsored ads? And they said, no, I always click on the organic search results. And I said, especially when I get to the chapter on auctions, I say, look, you guys, the high value bidder is going to win that auction. And so I want the high value bidder to click only on the sponsored ads, and that really sets the students off because it's the result of this auction, which identifies the high value bidder. I want the high value bidder winning my click. And so I click on them.
Do you think that the current regulation or sort of the planned regulation around this, do you think, I mean, back to sort of this reinforcing bias conversation we were just having, that there's going to be that the system as is, sort of letting the sort of major players will tend to not just the position of the existing players, but also sort of their approach to the market. I mean, we are not just we're not competing on the best car anymore. We are designing the concept of cars while trying to pretend that there's competition. I mean, I think I'm worried that we're going to get stuck with a, hey, cars are three-wheeled objects and we're going to do this and never have the sort of the glorious free market competition that we're talking about, because there isn't enough regulation to sort of stem the tide, stem the sort of the land grab that is happening in the AI space right now.
I think the real problem is that vision of competition is way too narrow. Just because one firm was the current winner and has a big market share, I don't think that necessarily means that they're not innovating or that they're not going to be displaced by somebody better, faster, quicker, cheaper in the future. And I like the idea that, and I think there's a huge difference across regulatory regimes in this. In the United States, we have this idea that we're going to design the incentives and just let competition, we're going to give competition a relatively free rein. But especially in Europe, they're much more kind of leery of the market. They want to make sure that they get out ahead of this stuff. And so they've written rules for AI already before they even know what the problems are. And so they already have a new Digital Markets Act that is, I think, way cart before the horse. It's just, and whereas in the United States, we have this notion of the common law that's going to evolve. And as we see problems arrive, you're going to see lawsuits, you're going to see the what organically arrive when the problems first appear, and then the regulation or the enforcement. And a lot of the agencies don't like to think of themselves as regulators, but they think of their, hey, we're enforcing the law. But the law is evolving too, and regulation has a bad name in for good reason. It has a really bad reputation in this country, whereas enforcement is supposed to be okay. And so a lot of the agencies think of themselves as enforcers, not regulators, even though what they do is a combination of the two. But the Europeans are much more on the regulatory side and trying to get out ahead of problems before they occur. And I think that the unfortunate consequence of that is a lack of innovation. You see most of the unicorns being born in the United States, and I think that's for good reason. And you see the average age of the top five firms in the United States is 40 years old, where the top five firms in Europe is over 100 years old. And I think that's a really good indicator of, you know, the strength of the incentive system. Let's let firms go out of business. So individual firms may go out of business, but the system that as a whole gets stronger because their customers, their engineers, their profits go to other survivors who are better for some reason, who didn't fail. And I think that's a great feature of our economy. Whereas in Europe, they protect individual firms. They don't want individual firms to go out of, they're just not set up to tolerate the change, or they don't appreciate it. And I think innovation, I think that's really going to harm them in the long run.
So this is a great point about this kind of anti, when I think about the, to your point, when I think about the search space, we don't Ink to Me today. We don't to Yahoo for the most part, unless we're like a Verizon customer or something. I think Google was maybe like the 12th search engine. All that stuff that we used to pitch about first mover advantage and all that turns out is not really real. It's like you got a very slight advantage. So let's think about, would search be the closest analog to, in terms of global play opportunity, would search be the closest analog to generative AI in terms of the market impact and what's happened? And what can you tell us about that in terms of regulation?
Yeah, so Google's being sued right now by the Justice Department for monopolizing general search. They've gerrymandered the market to exclude places like Amazon, which a lot of product searches begin on Amazon. And because that's the way you bring in an antitrust case, you gerrymander the market so that, or you define the market. I won't say gerrymander, you define the market. And if the market share, you got to show that somebody's a monopolist first, but we show they're dominant, and then they're abusing their dominant position. Those are the words that the Europeans use. And so they've showed that. And then, but if you think about it, you think about it, it goes back to this idea of dynamic competition, that Google may be dominant now, but if they, and you see this in the trial, you see this in the trial record, they're scared to death that somebody's going to come up with a better algorithm or better search, and they're going to be the Yahoo of tomorrow. And that's what I mean by the dynamic AI. Schumpeter, this economist, and I'm not a historian because I don't want, anyway, but Schumpeter called this the process of creative destruction. Today's monopolist becomes tomorrow's roadkill. And that is great. We let the firms fail. As long as we can let the firms fail, we're going to be much, much better off than systems or countries or whatever that don't let the firms fail. So it makes the organism stronger or anti-fragile, in the words of Victor Taleb. Nassim Nicholas Taleb, anti-fragile. They make them stronger. So the system is stronger, even though the individual components of the system may die off.
That kind of takes me to two other questions. One about like large language models themselves, and this may be a little off topic, but large language models themselves seems like there's this kind of monolithic, non-traceable, massive thing. Whereas, might it be more anti-fragile to have medium-sized language models that were trained on various corpuses that could then compete in an open network and have essentially a market of language models that would compete various things and therefore have traceability and other things that might provide at least more transparency about where the results are coming from?
Okay, you've just committed what economists call the Nirvana fallacy. You can imagine a world where that's better than today. Why don't we have that world? I don't know why we don't have it. I don't know. You don't know. But you're willing to propose. I know you're not. I know you're just throwing this out as a question. But if I took it seriously, I say you're willing to propose that Ed Powell be the dictator of the world, and you should decide, or you should let some government bureaucrat decide who is on a fixed salary and what drives them, what's their motive. Well, they want to do good. By and large, they want to do good. But as Ronald Reagan says, that's the scariest thing you can hear from a government regulator. Why? What gives them the information? How do we know that they're going to do good? I mean, it's why not let the market decide? And at least there are these competitive mechanisms that punish the losers and reward the winners. And at least the private firms that are competing in that market have incentives aligned to serve consumers. And the fact that we don't trust the market more to do the right thing, I think it's silly and naive. And that kind of top-down regulatory approach has failed over and over again.
Ed, you're right on that. Those models do already exist, but they are sold as one model, right? They are so sold. It's all behind the scenes work. So that approach is working. I think, but to loop to your point, where I'm seeing sort of the anti-fragility is actually in the open source models, in that there's this growing sort of collection of models that are trained and retrained and built and expanded by people who have maybe some downstream financial interest, but are not, but the initial work is not, they're not being compensated for, on the assumption that it actually sort of gives the community the advantage to compete against the sort of the open AI.
You started all those open language models and then turned them into the open source. Who invented all those things and turned them into open source? I bet you're talking about Microsoft, Apple, Google,
I felt some of the models have been growing out of called the research that is funded. So the approach has been funded by either nonprofits or large corporations. But I think Meta might be the only company that has actually published maybe code of their bleeding edge models with regularity. The others are holding tight to that advantage. So I think Llama is the one that is maybe the exception. But you know, there are I've been impressed by the open source community's ability to step up in this space, because the compute required to train these things is much more complex to maintain as an open source endeavor than just code. So it's been sort of, I'm interested to see how that shifts as either the models and the training gets more expensive, or the models come down in size and actually sort of gives an opening for greater competition from the open source community.
And so what are the incentives of the open source community needs to do that? And that's what I ask as an economist. And I would think, okay, if somebody offers a cool upgrade, everybody knows about it, and it enhances your reputation and your income and your employment opportunities. And so I would say, okay, that's a that's a that's a mechanism for advertising. And the people who contribute to those open source things are getting something out of it, maybe training, maybe advertising, maybe networking, whatever.
Absolutely. Yeah. Benefit.
There was, there's also a push in that space around people who thought that software should not be protectable intellectual property. And so they thought, well, what I'll do is I'll open source the code, but then people will have to hire me to implement it in their environment. And so in some cases, we've seen it at universities where the research gets open sourced as a mechanism for circumventing the technology transfer office, because then they can just move it outside the university and it's open, and then they can go be hired by various large companies to come implement it. So there are all kinds of incentives for people to open source their intellectual assets.
Oh, you're giving me some good ideas, Ed. Thanks.
Well, there's also, I think, some great stories online of people who have created and maintain very popular open source libraries that are used by companies like Apple and Meta, et cetera, and then don't get hired by those companies. Don't pass the coding test. Like, oh, you're not good enough. Even though they are maintaining code that all of those companies end up using anyway. So it is a different mechanism of reward, a different type of market transaction than typical, but you know, it is working. I am, you know, intrigued again, sort of to see how that shifts as the cost to build and improve and iterate on models brings down. And I think this is where, if you look at sort of where OpenAI and its most recent product iterations of Create Your Own GPT is trying to get ahead of this. They want to be the market. They want to undercut some of the open source need for adaptation and say, hey, don't bother setting up your own stuff. We'll handle 95% of it. You just give us the final 5 and customize it. I mean, I think that's going to throw a wrench in to a lot of the even sort of call it future antitrust concerns of a lot of these places, or maybe it'll make the case for them. Who knows?
No, I think it's
a whole new world.
It's funny, we don't treat nonprofits and for-profits differently in antitrust. We get competition from a nonprofit, we treat it exactly as competition from a profit. And I love the fact, I love competition. I think it's great wherever it comes from.
So what do you think the right structure is for managing? I think what I've heard from you is it would be based on markets. And so if we have these concerns about AI, et cetera, and it would not, and it's not best to leverage regulatory infrastructure, but just let the market decide. Do you have examples of kind of ways that's happened in other technologies?
Oh my goodness. Okay. I have to think of some, but yeah, I mean, at the Justice Department, we're always called on to look at standard setting organizations to make sure that they're not fixing prices, rigging bids, allocating customers, or limiting competition, but rather that they're doing the right thing. So we always oversee the standard setting organizations, I've seen those firsthand, and I think those are great. And you see patent pools where people get together and say, okay, all these patents are necessary for this stuff. We're gonna get together and form a patent pool, license them all together. So that's the kind of cooperation that you see, because the gains from innovation are so big, or they have other ways of monetizing that information.
So at present, we have a number of intellectual property lawsuits that have been filed related to large language models being trained on, say, Luke Frove's text. And,
yeah.
And then somehow that influencing information that comes out. Now, I want to preface it with this. I think Larry Page was who said, had we been in Britain, to your EU point at that time, we would have never been able to launch Google because of the copyright restrictions under British law versus, say, the American system. So with that, what do you think the future is for ownership of things like property rights and other copyrights, et cetera, as it pertains to these questions of large language models and this kind of meta model use of this information, not the direct copying, but its influence on generative AI?
Okay, so firstly, I'm not a lawyer, so I can't parse these IP, patent, and copyright questions. But I do think that it will make information a lot more valuable. And so if I can collect information that can train a model to do something really good, I'm going to, I got to anyway, I'm going to collect that information. I'll probably make my own generative AI on it to train to ask these questions. Or if somebody wants to hire me to train a model on their questions, you know, I think you'll see a lot of transactions, voluntary arm's length transactions, as long as we have freedom of contract in this country. And you can write a contract to do that and license your large language model. And I probably don't know enough about AI to see if that's feasible to do, or whether somebody could reverse engineer your AI to generate a bunch of training data. So anyway, but we'll figure out ways around that. And we'll be using AI to enforce copyright laws. I mean, yeah, I don't know if do you guys know Rick Beato? He's this singer-songwriter, a rock and roll musician who runs these shows, and he does this "What Makes This Song Great," and he'll tell you he'll play all these songs on the on his show and kind of deconstruct them and tell you exactly what's going on. It's a fabulous show, but he'll, in the middle of his things, just say, "I can't tell you the name of this song or the artist because they'll take it down." So as they put the various AI is flagging that and enforcing the copyright laws on the songs that Rick is playing. And so he knows enough to get around that. But I think that's a perfect example of how AI can be actually used to enforce the law, which raises another really interesting question. I don't want to monopolize the discussion here, but I'm really interested in Chicago is using AI to predict who's of the criminals in Chicago, who's going to recidivate, who's going to commit a crime again. And let's look at as we get more and more training data, we can get better predictions. And let's just start locking people up, you know, prematurely or before they commit crimes. Or let's go to China and let's predict who's going to be a dissident. They have a lot of data. They could easily train an AI system to figure out what are the characteristics that make a dissident and just lock people up. And anyway, I think those are the kind of the really scary, interesting questions that come with the increased predictability.
And I think you sort of hit on it in an earlier comment. There are underlying these assumptions. I think there's maybe a discussion right now that AI, this idea that AI is this like infinite wisdom, but the reality is that it is a tool. And if we can make multiple models, each with slightly different variations, then the real choice, the real question is, whose model do we pick? What are the incentives to train a model one way or the other way? And that's where you start seeing like, the incentive structures of those selling that model to the local justice system, whatever it may be, selling it to the government, that actually tells you a lot more about how these things are going to be used than necessarily the training model itself, because you can make it say whatever you want with enough data and enough purposeful, quote unquote, tuning or biasing, in other words. But yet again, I think it speaks to this. There are underlying economic influences and structures that we have to be aware of, that AI isn't the solution to them. It is just one part of a broader ecosystem.
I agree.
So James, what's your primary takeaway from today's conversation?
I think I really like the early conversation we had around sort of the cost of prediction sort of coming down, and the sort of idea that early lessons around machine learning that we can now draw to generative AI. I think that's going to ruminate. I'm going to ruminate on that for a bit. It's going to linger in my brain, because I do want to make sure that people are going back and saying, hey, we have made these mistakes before. How can we avoid making them again? We're using fancy new words, but they are the same underlying economic incentives, the same structures, same regulatory structures that we're trying to bend into this new way. So maybe the hard parts from the 1980s and 1990s are still going to be the hard parts today, and we shouldn't pretend like it's all brand new.
That's great. And Luke, what about for you?
Yeah, how can I have having this discussion? Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me. I really enjoyed it. I was surprised. And for me, it cemented this idea that, look, there's no way we can regulate this stuff. It's moving so fast. And any effort that we get in front of it is going to have disastrous consequences. You know, the reason we're so rich is technological innovation. That drives all of that makes the pie so big, and it puts us all where we are right now. And killing the goose that laid the golden egg. I mean, we don't want to affect innovation And my fear is that the regulatory structures are going to do that. And I think it's also clear that the best way to regulate these is let's let the people who have the best information and the best incentives make the decision, be they private sector or be they government. And I think that we ought not to automatically assume that government can make things better than the private sector, which unfortunately a lot of people do.
Yeah, it's really been fun as we thought about these things. I mean, I do think this idea of anti-fragility is a really good one. When we look at the world we live in, where we try to protect people, we have a big focus on things like safety. It's been shown that students are significantly more fragile. It's as if not only have we not provided them with cognitive behavioral therapy, but the policies have essentially been like anti-cognitive behavioral therapy. We've made them
preventing reacting to shocks. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And so what's interesting about that is I've also looked a lot at recently at a lot of training around things that have great goals, like leadership training in companies. What they found, there's a great Harvard Business Review article. What they found is the leadership training ended up just reinforcing whatever the culture was at the company. So it just made that better. And the same has happened with a lot of diversity and inclusion training. It's had the opposite effect of what you were hoping. So I'm always taken back to, I think it was Hayek who said that the goal of a policy is not what you say it is, but it's what it actually accomplishes. And in this case, I think the risks of going away from letting the market drive AI are much higher than the risks of having a Wild West free form of technology innovation. I think that is clearly the way to go. And I appreciate your spending the time with us, Luke.
You're welcome. Anytime. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you again, Luke.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thanks, guys.
Thanks again, everyone, for joining us today. And please do check out this season's new episodes to join our discovery journey as we explore the AI arena, pressure testing hype versus reality, and understanding where practical applications of these capabilities are shaping ecosystemic futures. Follow us and subscribe on Apple Podcasts for your favorite place to access podcasts. And you can always learn more at shushumworks.com.